CD 10.
Evans was acutely aware of the cameras on him. He nodded, in what he hoped was a judicious, thoughtful manner, and said, "And where does this data come from?" "From the Historical Climatology Network dataset," she said. "It's a government dataset, maintained at Oak Ridge National Laboratories." "Well," Evans said, "it's quite interesting. However, I'd like to see the data from Europe and Asia. This is, after all, a global phenomenon." "Certainly," Jennifer said. She too was playing to the cameras. "But before we do that, I'd like your reaction to the data so far. As you can see, many places in the United States do not seem to have become warmer since 1930.
"I'm sure you cherry-picked your data," Evans said.
"To some degree, as we can be sure the defense will do."
"But the results do not surprise me," Evans said. "Weather varies locally. It always has and always will." A thought occurred to him.
"By the way, why are all these graphs since 1930?
Temperature records go much further back than that."
"Your point is well taken," Jennifer said, nodding. "It definitely makes a difference how far back you go. For example, here is West Point, New York, from 1931 to 2000, trending down, and here is West Point from 1900 to 2000. This time the trend is up, not down."
"Aha," Evans said. "So you were massaging the data. You picked the interval of years that made you look good."
"Absolutely," Jennifer said, nodding. "But the trick only works because temperatures in many parts of the U.S. were warmer in the 1930s than they are today."
"It's still a trick."
"Yes, it is. The defense will not miss the opportunity to show the jury numerous examples of this trick from environmental fundraising literature, selecting specific years that appear to show things are getting worse."
Evans registered her insult to environmental groups. "In that case," he said, "let's not permit any tricks at all. Use the full and complete temperature record. How far back does it go?"
"At West Point? Back to 1826.
"Okay. Then suppose you use that." Evans felt confident proposing this, because it was well known that a worldwide warming trend had begun at about 1850. Every place in the world had gotten warmer since then, and the graph from West Point would reflect that. Jennifer seemed to know, too, because she suddenly appeared very hesitant, turning away, thumbing through her stack of graphs, frowning as if she couldn't find it.
"You don't have that particular graph, do you?" Evans said.
"No, no, believe me, I have it. Yes. Here." And then she pulled it out.
Evans took one look and saw that she had sandbagged him.
"As you predicted, this graph is quite telling," she said. "For the last 174 years, there has been no change in the average temperature at West Point. It was 51 degrees Fahrenheit in 1826, and it is 51 degrees in 2000.
"But that's just one record," Evans said, recovering quickly.
"One of many. One of hundreds, thousands." "You're saying that other records will show other trends?"
"I'm sure they will, especially using the full record from 1826.
"And you are correct," she said. "Different records do show different trends."
Evans sat back, satisfied with himself, hands crossed over his chest.
"New York City, a rise of 5 degrees Fahrenheit in 178 years. Albany, a decline of half a degree in 180 years.
Evans shrugged. "Local variations, as I said before.
"But I wonder," Jennifer said, "how these local variations fit into a theory of global warming. As I understand it, global warming is caused by an increase in so-called greenhouse gases, such as carbon dioxide, that trap heat in the Earth's atmosphere and prevent it from escaping into space. Is that your understanding?"
"Yes," Evans said, grateful he did not have to summon a definition on his own.
"So according to the theory," Jennifer said,
The atmosphere itself gets warmer, just as it would inside a greenhouse.
Yes.
And these greenhouse gases affect the entire planet.
Yes.
And we know that carbon dioxide, the gas we all worry about, has increased the same amount everywhere in the world.
She pulled out another graph.
Yes. And its effect is presumably the same everywhere in the world. That's why it's called global warming.
Yes.
But New York and Albany are only 140 miles apart. You can drive between them in 3 hours. Their carbon dioxide levels are identical, yet one got a lot warmer and the other got slightly colder. Is that evidence for global warming?
Weather is local, Evans said. Some places are warmer or colder than others, and always will be.
But we are talking about climate, not weather. Climate is weather over a long time period.
Yes.
So I would agree with you if both locations got warmer, albeit by different amounts. But here, one got warmer and one got colder. And as we saw, West Point, which is midway between them, remained unchanged.
Evans said, I think the theory of global warming predicts that some places will get colder.
Really? Why is that?
I'm not sure, but I read it somewhere.
The Earth's entire atmosphere warms, and as a result, some places get colder?
I believe so.
As you think about it now, does that claim make sense to you?
No, Evans said, but you know climate is a complex system.
Which means what, to you?
It means it's, complicated. It doesn't always behave the way you think it will.
That's certainly true, Jennifer said. But going back to New York and Albany, the fact that these two locations are so close, yet their temperature records are so different, could lead a jury to wonder whether we're really measuring something other than a global effect. You would agree that in the last 185 years, New York has grown to a city of 8 million, whereas Albany has grown much less.
Yes, Evans said.
And we know that the urban heat island effect makes cities hotter than the surrounding countryside.
Yes.
And this urban heat effect is a local effect, unrelated to global warming.
Yes.
So tell me, how do you know that the dramatic increase in temperature in New York is caused by global warming, and not just from an excess of concrete and skyscrapers?
Well, Evans hesitated. I don't know the answer to that, but I assume it is known.
Because if cities like New York become larger and hotter than they were before, they will raise the average global temperature, will they not?
I assume they will.
In which case, as cities expand all around the world, we might see an increase in average ground temperature simply because of urbanization, without any global atmospheric effect at all.
I am sure the scientists have thought of that already, Evans said.
I am sure they can answer that. Yes, they can. Their answer is that they have subtracted a factor from the raw data to compensate for the urban heat effect.
Well, there you are.
Excuse me. Mr. Evans, you're a lawyer. Surely you are aware of the extraordinary efforts that are made in a lawsuit to be certain the evidence is untainted.
Yes, but...
You don't want anybody to be able to change it.
Yes,
but in this case... The evidence is raw temperature data, and it is tainted by the very scientists who claim global warming is a worldwide crisis.
Tainted? It's adjusted downward.
But the question the defense will ask is, have they adjusted downward enough?
I don't know, Evans said.
This is getting very specialized and nitpicky. Hardly. It's a core issue. Urbanization versus greenhouse gases as the cause of the increased average surface temperature, and the defense will have a good argument on their side,
Jennifer said.
As I said before, several recent studies suggest the reduction for urban bias has, in fact, been too small.
At least one study suggests that half of the observed temperature change comes from land use alone. If that's true, then global warming in the past century is less than 0.3 degrees. Not exactly a crisis. Evans said nothing. He tried to look intelligent for the cameras. Of course, Jennifer continued. That study can be debated, too. But the point remains, as soon as anybody adjusts the data, they open themselves to the claim that their adjustment was incorrect. That's better ground for the defense. And the larger point the defense will make is that we have allowed the data to be adjusted by the very people who have the most to gain from that adjustment.
You're saying that climate scientists are unethical?
I'm saying it is never a good policy for the fox to guard the hen house. Such procedures are never allowed in medicine, for example, where double-blind experimental designs are required.
So you're saying climate scientists are unethical?
No. I'm saying that there are good reasons why double-blind procedures are instituted. Look, every scientist has some idea of how his experiment is going to turn out. Otherwise, he wouldn't do the experiment in the first place. He has an expectation. But expectation works in mysterious ways, and totally unconsciously. Do you know any of the studies of scientific bias?
No. Evan shook his head.
Okay, simple example. A group of genetically identical rats are sent to two different labs for testing. One lab is told that the rats are bred for intelligence and will run a maze faster than normal. The other lab is told that the rats are dumb and will run a maze slowly. Results come back. Faster in one lab, slower in the other. Yet the rats are genetically identical.
Okay, so they're fudged.
They say they didn't. Anyway, there's much more, she said. Next example. A group of survey takers are told, look, we know that pollsters can influence results in subtle ways. We want to avoid that. So you knock on the door, and the minute someone answers, you start reading only what is on this card. Hello, I am doing a survey, and I am reading from this card in order not to influence you, etc. The poll takers say nothing except what is on the card. One group of pollsters is told this questionnaire will get 70% positive answers. They tell another group you can expect 30% positive answers. Identical questionnaires. The results come back. 70 and 30.
How? Evans said.
It doesn't matter, she said. All that matters is that hundreds of studies prove again and again that expectations determine outcome. People find what they think they'll find. That's the reason for double-blind experiments. To eliminate bias, the experiment is divided up among different people who do not know each other. The people who prepare the experiment do not know the people who conduct the experiment or the people who analyze the results. These groups never communicate in any way. Their spouses and children never meet. The groups are in different universities and preferably in different countries. That's how new drugs are tested. Because that's the only way to prevent bias from creeping in.
Okay.
So now we're talking about temperature data. It has to be adjusted in all kinds of ways. Not just for urban heat bias. Lots of other things. Stations move. They upgrade, and new equipment may read hotter or colder than before. The equipment malfunctions, and you have to decide whether to throw out certain data. You deal with lots of judgment calls in putting together the temperature record. And that's where the bias creeps in, possibly.
Possibly?
You don't know, Jennifer said. But whenever you have one team doing all the jobs, then you're at risk for bias. If one team makes a model and also tests it, and also analyzes the results, those results are at risk. They just are.
So the temperature data are no good.
The temperature data are suspect. A decent attorney will tear them apart. To defend them, what we intend to do is...
Abruptly, the camera crew got up and left the room. Jennifer rested her hand on his arm. Don't worry about any of that. The footage they shot was without sound. I just wanted it to look like a lively discussion.
I feel foolish.
You looked good. That's all that matters for TV.
No, he said, leaning closer to her. I mean, when I gave those answers, I wasn't saying what I really think. I'm changing my mind about a lot of this stuff.
Really?
Yes, he said, speaking quietly. Those graphs of temperature, for instance, they raise obvious questions about the validity of global warming. She nodded slowly, looking at him closely. He said, "You too?" She continued to nod.
They lunched at the same Mexican restaurant as before. It was almost empty, as before. The same Sony film editors laughing at the corner table. They must come here every day, Evans thought. But somehow everything was different, and not just because his body ached and he was on the verge of falling asleep any moment. Evans felt as if he had become a different person, and their relationship was different too. Jennifer ate quietly, not saying much. Evans had the sense she was waiting for him. After a while, he said, "You know, it would be crazy to imagine that global warming wasn't a real phenomenon."
"Crazy,"
she said, nodding. "I mean, the whole world believes it."
"Yes," she said, "the whole world does.
But in that war room, we think only about the jury. And the defense will have a field day with the jury."
"You mean the example you told me?"
"Oh, it's much worse than that. We expect the defense to argue like this. Ladies and gentlemen of the jury, you've all heard the claim that something called global warming is occurring because of an increase in carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. But what you haven't been told is that carbon dioxide has increased by only a tiny amount. They'll show you a graph of increasing carbon dioxide that looks like the slope of Mount Everest. But here's the reality. Carbon dioxide has increased from 316 parts per million to 376 parts per million. 60 parts per million is the total increase. Now that's such a small change in our entire atmosphere that it is hard to imagine. How can we visualize that?"
Jennifer sat back, swung her hands wide.
"Next, they'll bring out a chart showing a football field. And they'll say, imagine the composition of the Earth's atmosphere as a football field. Most of the atmosphere is nitrogen. So starting from the goal line, nitrogen takes you all the way to the 78-yard line. And most of what's left is oxygen. Oxygen takes you to the 99-yard line, only 1 yard to go. But most of what remains is the inert gas argon. Argon brings you within 3.5 inches of the goal line. That's pretty much the thickness of the chalk stripe, folks. And how much of that remaining 3 inches is carbon dioxide? 1 inch. That's how much CO2 we have in our atmosphere. 1 inch in a 100-yard football field."
She paused dramatically, then continued. "Now, ladies and gentlemen of the jury," she said, "you are told that carbon dioxide has increased in the last 50 years. Do you know how much it has increased on our football field? It has increased by 3/8 of an inch, less than the thickness of a pencil. It's a lot more carbon dioxide, but it's a minuscule change in our total atmosphere. Yet you are asked to believe that this tiny change has driven the entire planet into a dangerous warming pattern."
Evans said, "But that's easily answered."
"Wait," she said. "They're not done. First, raise doubts, then offer alternative explanations. So now, they take out that temperature chart for New York City that you saw before, a 5-degree increase since 1815. And they say, back in 1815, the population of New York was 120,000. Today it's 8 million. The city has grown by 6,000%. to say nothing of all those skyscrapers and air conditioning and concrete. Now I ask you, is it reasonable to believe that a city that has grown by 6,000% is hotter because of a tiny increase in little old carbon dioxide around the world? Or is it hotter because it is now much, much bigger? She sat back in her chair. But it's easy to counter that argument, Evans said. There are many examples of small things that produce big effects. A trigger represents a small part of a gun, but it's enough to fire it. And anyway, the preponderance of the evidence. Peter, she said, shaking her head. If you were on the jury and you were asked that question about New York City, what would you conclude? Global warming or too much concrete? What do you think, anyway?
I think it's probably hotter because it's a big city.
Right.
But you still have the sea level argument.
Unfortunately, she said, the sea levels at Vanuatu are not significantly elevated. Depending on the database, they're either flat or they've increased by 40 millimeters. Half an inch in 30 years, almost nothing.
Then you can't possibly win this case, Evans said.
Exactly, she said. Although I have to say your trigger argument is a nice one.
If you can't win, Evans said, then what is this press conference about?
Thank you all for coming, John Balder said, stepping up to a cluster of microphones outside the offices. Photographers' strobes flashed. I am John Balder, and standing with me is Nicholas Drake, the president of the National Environmental Resource Fund. Here also is Jennifer Haynes, my legal counsel, and Peter Evans of the law firm of Hassel & Black. Together we are announcing that we will be filing a lawsuit against the Environmental Protection Agency of the United States on behalf of the island nation of Vanuatu in the Pacific.
Standing in the back, Peter Evans started to bite his lip, then thought better of it. No reason to make a facial expression that might be construed as nervous.
The impoverished people of Vanuatu, Balder said, stand to become even more impoverished by the greatest environmental threat of our times, global warming, and the danger of abrupt climate changes that will surely follow.
Evans recalled that just a few days before, Drake had called abrupt climate change a possibility on the horizon. Now it had been transformed into a certainty in less than a week.
Balder spoke in vivid terms about how the people of Vanuatu were being flooded out of their ancestral homeland, emphasizing the tragedy of young children whose heritage was washing away in raging surf caused by a callous industrial giant to the north.
It is a matter of justice for the people of Vanuatu, and of the future of the entire world now threatened by abrupt weather, that we're announcing this lawsuit today.
Then he opened the floor to questions. The first one was, when exactly are you filing this lawsuit?
The issue is technically complex, Balder said. Right now, we have in our offices 40 research scientists working on our behalf day and night. When they have finished their labors, we will make our filing for injunctive relief.
Where will you file?
In Los Angeles Federal District Court.
What damages are you asking? Another said.
What is the administration's response?
Will the court hear it?
The questions were coming quickly now, and Balder was in his element. Evans glanced over at Jennifer, standing on the other side of the podium. She tapped her watch. Evans nodded, then looked at his own watch, made a face, and exited the podium. Jennifer was right behind him. They went inside the warehouse and past the guards, and Evans stared in amazement.
Culver City, Tuesday, October 12th, 1:20 p.m. The lights were turned down. Most of the people Evans had seen earlier were gone. The rooms were being stripped, the furniture stacked up, the documents packed into legal storage boxes. Movers were carrying out stacks of boxes on rolling dollies. Evans said, "What's going on?"
"Our lease is up," Jennifer said.
"So you're moving?"
Jennifer shook her head. "No, we're leaving."
What do you mean?
I mean we're leaving, Peter, looking for new jobs. This litigation is no longer being actively pursued.
Over a loudspeaker, they heard Balder say, "We fully expect to seek an injunction within the next 3 months. I have complete confidence in the 40 brilliant men and women who are assisting us in this groundbreaking case."
Evan stepped back as movers carried a table past him. It was the same table he had been interviewed at just 3 hours before. Another mover followed, lugging boxes of video equipment.
"How is this going to work?"
Evan said, hearing Balder over the loudspeaker. "I mean, people are going to know what's happening."
"What's happening is perfectly logical," Jennifer said. "We will file a request for a preliminary injunction. Our pleading has to work its way through the system. We expect it to be rejected by the district court for jurisdiction. So, we will take it to the Ninth Circuit, and then we expect to go to the Supreme Court. The litigation cannot proceed until the issue of injunction is resolved, which could take several years. Therefore, we sensibly put our large research staff on hold and close our expensive offices while we wait with a skeleton legal team in place."
"Is there a skeleton team in place?"
"No, but you asked how it would be handled."
Evans watched as the boxes rolled out the back door.
"Nobody ever intended to file this lawsuit, did they?"
"Let's put it this way," she said. "Balder has a remarkable winning record in the courtroom. There's only one way to build a record like that. You dump the losers long before you ever get to trial."
"So he's dumping this one?"
"Yeah. Because I guarantee you no court is going to grant injunctive relief for excess carbon dioxide production by the American economy."
She pointed to the loudspeaker.
"Drake got him to emphasize abrupt climate change. That nicely dovetails with Drake's conference, which starts tomorrow."
"Yes, but look," she said. "You know as well as I do that the whole purpose of this case was to generate publicity. They've got their press conference. There's no need to pursue it further."
She was asked by movers where to put things. Evans wandered back into the interrogation room and saw the stack of foam core graphs in the corner. He had wanted to see the ones she hadn't shown him, so he pulled a few out. They showed foreign weather stations around the world, Alice Springs, Australia, Clyde, NWT, Christchurch, New Zealand, Kamensko, Siberia. Of course, he knew that these particular charts had been chosen to prove the opposition's point, so they showed little or no warming. But still, it troubled him that there should be so many like these from all around the world. He saw a stack marked Europe and shuffled through them quickly. Rome, Italy. Paris, La Bourget. Milano, Linati. Stuttgart, Germany. Navacerrada, Spain. Gothenburg, Sweden. There was another stack marked Asia. He flipped through it. Koshi, Japan. Lahore City, Pakistan. Takayama, Japan. Tokyo, Japan.
"Peter!"
She was calling him. Her own office was already packed up. She had only a few boxes of things. He helped her carry them out to her car.
"So," he said, "what are you doing now? Going back to D.C. and your boyfriend?"
"I don't think so," she said.
"Then what?"
"Actually, I thought I'd go with you."
"With me?
You're working with John Kenner, aren't you?"
Evans said,
"How did you know that?"
She just smiled.
Heading out the back door, they heard the loudspeaker from the conference. Drake was talking now, thanking the press for coming, urging them to attend his forthcoming conference, and saying that the real danger from global warming was its potential for abrupt climate change. And then he said,
"Excuse me, but I regret to say, I have an extremely sad announcement to make. I have just been handed a note that says the body of my dear friend, George Morton, has just been found."
Culver City, Tuesday, October 12th, 2:15 p.m.
The full story was on the news that afternoon. The body of millionaire financier George Morton had washed up on the shore near Pismo Beach. The identification was made from clothing and from a watch on the victim's wrist. The body itself was mutilated, the result of shark attacks, the newscaster said. The family of the philanthropist had been notified, but no date for the memorial service had been set. There was a statement from Morton's close friend, Nicholas Drake, director of NERF. Drake said that Morton had devoted his life to the environmental movement and to the work of organizations like NERF, which had just recently named him their Concerned Citizen of the Year.
If anyone was concerned about the terrible changes that are taking place around our globe, it was George Morton, Drake said. Ever since we learned he was missing, we have been hoping against hope that he would be found in good spirits and good health. I am saddened to learn that this is not the case. I mourn the loss of my dear and dedicated friend. The world is poorer without him.
Evans was driving when Lowenstein called him on the car phone.
What are you doing?
Coming back from the press conference I was ordered to attend.
Where are you going to San Francisco?
Why?
Morton's been found. Somebody has to identify the body. What about his daughter? She's in rehab.
What about his ex-wife? What about...
Evans, you're officially assigned. Make your arrangements. The forensic guys don't want to delay the autopsy, so they'll need him ID'd before dinner. But get your ass up there. I don't know what you're bitching about. Take the guy's plane, for Christ's sake. You've certainly been helping yourself to it lately, from what I hear. Now that he's dead, you'd better be more careful. Oh, one more thing. Since you're not family, they'll need two people to ID him.
Well, I can take Sarah, his secretary.
No, Drake wants you to take Ted Bradley.
Why?
How the hell do I know? Bradley wants to go. Drake wants to indulge him, keep him happy. Bradley probably thinks there'll be news cameras there. He's an actor, after all, and he was George's close friend.
Sort of.
He was at the banquet table with you.
But Sarah would be...
Evans, what part of this do you not understand? You're going to San Francisco, and you're taking Bradley with you. Period.
Evans sighed. Where is he?
He's in Sequoia. You have to stop and get him.
Sequoia?
National Park. It's on the way. But Bradley's already been notified. My secretary will give you the number for the San Francisco morgue. Goodbye, Evans. Don't screw up.
Click. Jennifer said,
Problem?
No, but I have to go to San Francisco.
I'll come with you.
She said,
Who is Sarah?
Morton's personal secretary, his old assistant.
I've seen pictures of her, Jennifer said. She doesn't look very old.
Where did you see pictures?
In a magazine. They were at a tennis tournament. She's a championship tennis player, something like that.
I guess.
I would have thought that since you spend so much time with Morton, you'd know her well.
Not really, he said, shrugging. I mean, we've spent a little time in the last few days.
Uh-huh.
She looked at him, amused.
Peter, she said, I don't care. She's very pretty. It's only natural.
No. No, he said, reaching for the phone. It's nothing like that.
Desperate to put an end to this conversation, he dialed the Beverly Hills police and asked for Detective Perry. The detective was not yet back from court. Evans left a message and hung up. He turned to Jennifer.
How does it work if they issue a warrant for your arrest?
Criminal, she said. Not my area, sorry.
Me neither.
Somebody's going to arrest you?
I hope not.
Then Lisa, Herb Lowenstein's chatty assistant, called.
Hi, Peter. I have the numbers for Mr. Bradley and for the San Francisco morgue. They close at 8. Can you make it by then? Herb wants to know. He's very upset.
What about?
I've never seen him this way. I mean, not for a few weeks.
What's the matter?
I think he's upset about George. Such a shock. And then Drake is giving him fits. He must have called 5 times today, and I think they were discussing you.
Me?
Yes. Lisa lowered her voice, taking on a conspiratorial tone. Herb had his door closed while he was talking, but I heard a few things.
Like what? Evans said.
Don't say anything.
I won't.
I mean, I wasn't. I just thought you would want to know.
I do.
Because there's a lot of talk here,
she said, dropping her voice even lower,
about whether you have to leave.
Leave the firm?
Let go. I thought you would want to know.
I do. Thanks. Who's talking?
Well, Herb, and Don Blandings, and a couple of other senior partners, Bob and Louise. Because for some reason, Nick Drake is furious with you. And somebody you were spending time with, a person named Canner or Connor?
I see.
Mr. Drake is very upset about Mr. Connor.
Why is that?
He says he is a spy. For industry. For polluters.
I see.
Anyway, the feeling is Mr. Drake is an important client, and you've pissed him off.
Even so, they would never dare fire you if Morton were alive.
But he's not anymore. And you're gone all the time. And the police are calling here for you, which I have to tell you is not good. It makes everybody nervous. And then they... What are you doing with this Mr. Connor anyway?
It's a long story.
Peter, I told you.
She sounded sulky. He knew he would have to trade information. Okay, he said, trying to sound reluctant. I'm carrying out an assignment that Morton gave me before he died.
Really? What is it?
It's a secret. I can't tell you yet.
George Morton gave you an assignment?
In writing, he said, thinking that will cool their jets.
Wow! Really? They don't dare fire you if you're on the business of the firm. Lisa, I have to go. And if they did, you would have such a wrongful termination action. Lisa, okay, I know you can't talk, but just good luck.
He hung up. Jennifer was smiling.
That was very skillfully done, she said.
Thank you. But he wasn't smiling back. As far as he was concerned, the world was closing in around him. It didn't feel good. And he was still very, very tired. He called Sarah to arrange for the plane, but got her voicemail. He called the pilot and was told that he was in the air. What do you mean? He's flying right now.
Where?
I can't tell you that, sir. Would you like his voicemail?
No, Evan said. I need to charter a plane.
When would you like it?
In half an hour. To go to San Francisco, with a stop at whatever the airport is nearest Sequoia, returning tonight.
I'll see what I can do.
And then fatigue overcame him. He pulled to the side of the road and got out of the car. Jennifer said, What's the matter?
You know the way to Van Nuys?
Sure.
Then you drive.
He dropped into the passenger seat and fastened his seat belt. He watched her pull into traffic and then closed his eyes and slept.
Sequoia, Tuesday, October 12th, 4:30 p.m.
The forest floor was dark and cool. Shafts of sunlight filtered down from the magnificent trees rising all around them. The air smelled of pine. The ground was soft underfoot. It was a pleasant spot, with sunlight dappling the forest floor. But even so, the television cameras had to turn on their lights to film the third-grade school children who sat in concentric circles around the famous actor and activist Ted Bradley. Bradley was wearing a black T-shirt that set off his makeup and his dark good looks.
These glorious trees are your birthright, he said, gesturing all around him. They have been standing here for centuries. Long before you were born, before your parents or your grandparents or your great-grandparents were born. Some of them before Columbus came to America.
before the Indians came, before anything. These trees are the oldest living things on the planet. They are the guardians of the earth. They are wise, and they have a message for us. Leave the planet alone. Don't mess with it or with us. And we must listen to them.
The kids stared, open-mouthed, transfixed. The cameras were trained on Bradley.
But now these magnificent trees, having survived the threat of fire, the threat of logging, the threat of soil erosion, the threat of acid rain, now face their greatest threat ever, global warming.
You kids know what global warming is, don't you?
Hands went up all around the circle.
I know.
I'm glad you do, Bradley said, gesturing for the kids to put their hands down. The only person talking today would be Ted Bradley.
But you may not know that global warming is going to cause a very sudden change in our climate. Maybe just a few months or years, and it will suddenly be much hotter or much colder. And there will be hordes of insects and diseases that will take down these wonderful trees.
What kind of insects?
One kid asked. Bad ones, Bradley said. The ones that eat trees, that worm inside them and chew them up.
He wiggled his hands, suggesting the worming in progress.
It would take an insect a long time to eat a whole tree,
a girl offered. No, it wouldn't, Bradley said. That's the trouble, because global warming means lots and lots of insects will come, a plague of insects, and they'll eat the trees first.
Standing to one side, Jennifer leaned close to Evans. Do you believe this shit?
Evans yawned. He had slept on the flight up and had dozed off again in the ride from the airport to this grove in Sequoia National Park. He felt groggy now, looking at Bradley. Groggy and bored. By now, the kids were fidgeting, and Bradley turned squarely to the cameras. He spoke with the easy authority he had mastered while playing the president for so many years on television.
The threat of abrupt climate change, he said, is so devastating for mankind and for all life on this planet that conferences are being convened all around the world to deal with it. There's a conference in Los Angeles starting tomorrow where scientists will discuss what we can do to mitigate this terrible threat. But if we do nothing, catastrophe looms. And these mighty, magnificent trees will be a memory, a postcard from the past, a snapshot of man's inhumanity to the natural world. We're responsible for catastrophic climate change, and only we can stop it.
He finished, with a slight turn to favor his good side, and a piercing stare from his baby blues right into the lens.
I have to pee-pee,
one girl said.
The plane lifted off the runway and rose over the forest.
Sorry to rush you, Evans said, but we have to get to the morgue before 6.
No problem, Bradley smiled indulgently. After his talk, he had taken a few minutes to sign autographs for the kids. The cameras filmed that as well. He turned to Jennifer, giving her his best smile.
And what do you do, Miss Hadley?
I'm on the global warming legal team.
Good, so you're one of us. How's the lawsuit going?
Just fine, she said, glancing at Evans.
I get the feeling you're as brilliant as you are beautiful, Bradley said.
Actually, no, she said. Evans could see that the actor was annoying her.
You're being modest.
It's very charming.
I'm being honest, she said. I'm telling you I don't like flattery.
Hardly flattery in your case, he said.
And hardly honest in yours, she replied.
Believe me when I say that I genuinely admire what you're doing, Bradley said.
I can't wait for you people to stick it to the EPA. We have to keep the pressure on. That's why I did this thing with the kids. It's a surefire television segment for abrupt climate change. And I thought it went extremely well. Didn't you?
Reasonably well, considering.
Considering?
That it was all bullshit, Jennifer said. Bradley's smile remained fixed, but his eyes narrowed.
I'm not sure what you're referring to, he said.
I'm referring to all of it, Ted, the whole speech. Sequoias are sentinels and guardians of the planet. They have a message for us?
Well, they do.
They're trees, Ted. Big trees. They have about as much of a message for mankind as an eggplant.
I think you are missing.
And they've managed to survive forest fires? Hardly. They're dependent on fires, because that's how they reproduce. Redwoods have tough seeds that only burst open in the heat of a fire. Fires are essential for the health of the redwood forest.
I think, Bradley said rather stiffly, that you may have missed my point.
Really? What did I miss?
I was trying to convey, perhaps a bit lyrically, the timeless quality of these great primeval forests and...
Timeless? Primeval? Do you know anything about these forests?
Yes, I think I do.
His voice was tight. He was visibly angry now. Look out the window, Jennifer said, pointing to the forest as they flew above it. How long do you think your primeval forest has looked the way it does now?
Obviously, for hundreds of thousands of years.
Not true, Ted. Human beings were here for many thousands of years before these forests ever appeared. Did you know that? He was clenching his jaw. He did not answer. Then let me lay it out for you, she said. 20,000 years ago, the Ice Age glaciers receded from California, gouging out Yosemite Valley and other beauty spots as they left. As the ice walls withdrew, they left behind a gunky, damp plain with lots of lakes fed by the melting glaciers, but no vegetation at all. It was basically wet sand. After 1,000 years, the land dried as the glaciers continued to move farther north. This region of California became Arctic tundra, with tall grasses supporting little animals like mice and squirrels. Human beings had arrived here by then, hunting the small animals and setting fires. Okay so far? Jennifer said. No primeval forests yet.
I'm listening, Ted growled. He was clearly trying to control his temper.
She continued. At first, Arctic grasses and shrubs were the only plants that could take hold in the barren glacial soil. But when they died, they decomposed, and over thousands of years, a layer of topsoil built up. And that initiated a sequence of plant colonization that was basically the same everywhere in post-glacial North America. First, lodgepole pine comes in. That's around 14,000 years ago. Later, it's joined by spruce, hemlock, and alder. Trees that are hardy, but can't be first. These trees constitute the real primary forest, and they dominated this landscape for the next 4,000 years. Then the climate changed. It got much warmer, and all the glaciers in California melted. There were no glaciers at all in California back then. It was warm and dry. There were lots of fires, and the primary forest burned. It was replaced by a plains-type vegetation of oak trees and prairie herbs, and a few Douglas fir trees, but not many, because the climate was too dry for fir trees. Then around 6,000 years ago, the climate changed again. It became wetter, and the Douglas fir, hemlock, and cedar moved in and took over the land, creating the great closed canopy forests that you see now. But someone might refer to these fir trees as a pest plant, an oversized weed that invaded the landscape, crowding out the native plants that had been there before them. Because these big canopy forests made the ground too dark for other trees to survive. And since there were frequent fires, the closed canopy forests were able to spread like mad,
So they're not timeless, Ted. They're merely the last in line.
Bradley snorted. They're still 6,000 years old, for God's sake.
But Jennifer was relentless. Not true, she said. Scientists have shown that the forests continuously changed their composition. Each 1,000-year period was different from the one before it. The forests changed constantly, Ted. And then, of course, there were the Indians.
What about them?
The Indians were expert observers of the natural world, so they realized that old-growth forests sucked. These forests may look impressive, but they're dead landscapes for game. So the Indians set fires, making sure the forests burned down periodically. They made sure there were only islands of old-growth forest in the midst of plains and meadows. The forests that the first Europeans saw were hardly primeval. They were cultivated, Ted. And it's not surprising that 150 years ago, there were less old-growth forests than there is today. The Indians were realists. Today it's all romantic mythology.
She sat back in her chair. Well, that's a very nice speech, Bradley said. But those are technical objections. People aren't interested. And it's a good thing, because you're saying that these forests aren't really old and therefore aren't worth preserving. Whereas I say they are reminders of the beauty and power of the natural world and should be preserved at all costs, especially from the dire threat of global warming.
Jennifer blinked. She said, I need a drink.
I'll join you there, Bradley said.
For Evans, who had intermittently been attempting to call Detective Parry while this discussion was taking place, the most disturbing aspect was the implication of constant change. Evans had never really focused on the idea that Indians had lived at the same time as the glaciers. Of course, he knew that this was true. He knew that early Indians had hunted the mammoth and other large mammals to extinction. But he had never considered the possibility that they would also have burnt forests and changed the environment to suit their purposes. But of course they had. Equally disturbing was the image of so many different forests taking over, one after another. Evans had never wondered what had existed before the redwood forests. He, too, had considered them primeval. Nor had he ever thought about the landscape that the glaciers would have left behind. Thinking about it now, he realized that it probably looked like the land he had recently seen in Iceland. Cold, wet, rocky, and barren. It stood to reason that generations of plants would have to grow there, building up a layer of topsoil. But in his mind, he had always imagined a sort of animated movie in which the glaciers receded and redwood trees popped up immediately along the receding edge. The glaciers pulled away, leaving redwood forest behind. He realized how silly that view had been. And Evans had also noticed, in passing, how frequently Jennifer had spoken of a changing climate. First it was cold and wet, then it was warm and dry and the glaciers melted. Then it was wetter again, and the glaciers came back, changing and changing again. Constant change. After a while, Bradley excused himself and went to the front of the plane to call his agent. Evans said to Jennifer, How do you know all that stuff? For the reason Bradley himself mentioned, the dire threat of global warming. We had a whole team researching the dire threats because we wanted to find anything we could to make our case as impressive as possible. And? She shook her head. The threat of global warming, she said, is essentially non-existent. Even if it were a real phenomenon, it would probably result in a net benefit to most of the world. The pilot clicked on the intercom, telling them to take their seats because they were on their final approach to San Francisco. San Francisco, Tuesday, October 12th, 6:31 p.m. The anteroom was gray, cold, and smelled of disinfectant.
The man behind the desk wore a lab coat. He typed at his keyboard.
Morton. Morton. Yes, George Morton. Okay. And you are?
Peter Evans. I'm Mr. Morton's attorney, Evans said.
And I'm Ted Bradley, Ted said.
He started to extend his hand, then thought better of it, pulled it back.
Oh, hey, the technician said. I thought you looked familiar. You're the Secretary of State.
Actually, I'm the president.
Right, right, the president. I knew I'd seen you before. Your wife is a drunk.
No, actually, the Secretary of State's wife is a drunk.
Oh,
well, I don't get to see the show that often. It's off the air now.
That explains it.
But it's in syndication in all the major markets.
Evans said, if we could make the identification now.
Okay, sign here. I'll get you visitor tags.
Jennifer remained in the anteroom. Evans and Bradley walked into the morgue. Bradley looked back.
Who is she, anyway?
She's an attorney working on the global warming team.
I think she's a plant for industry. She's obviously some kind of extremist.
She works right under Balder, Ted.
Well, I can understand that, Bradley said, sniggering. I'd like her working under me, too.
Did you listen to her, for God's sake? Old growth forests suck?
That's industry talking.
He leaned closer to Evans.
I think you should get rid of her.
Get rid of her? She's up to no good. Why is she with us now, anyway?
I don't know.
She wanted to come. Why are you with us, Ted?
I have a job to do.
The sheet draping the body was spotted with gray stains. The technician lifted it back.
Oh, Jesus!
Ted Bradley said, turning quickly away. Evans forced himself to gaze at the body. Morton had been a large man in life, and now he was even larger, his torso purple-gray and bloated. The odor of decay was strong. Indenting the puffy flesh was an inch-wide ring around one wrist. Evans said, "The watch?"
"Yeah, we took it off," the technician said. "Barely got it over the hand. You need to see it?"
"Yes, I do." Evans leaned closer and stiffened his body against the smell. He wanted to look at the hands and the nails. Morton had had a childhood injury to the fourth nail on his right hand, leaving the nail dented, deformed. But one of the hands of this body was missing, and the other was gnawed and mangled. There was no way he could be sure of what he was seeing. Behind him, Bradley said,
"Are you done yet?"
"Not quite."
"Jesus, man!"
The technician said,
"So, will the show go back on the air?"
"No, it's been canceled."
"Why?" "I like that show."
"They should have consulted you," Bradley said.
Evans was looking at the chest now, trying to recall the pattern of chest hair that Morton had had. He'd seen him often enough in a bathing suit. But the bloating, the stretching of the skin made it difficult. He shook his head. He could not be sure it was Morton.
"Are you done yet?" Bradley said.
"Yes," Evans said. The drape went back on, and they walked out. The technician said,
"Lifeguards in Pismo made the discovery, called the police. The police ID'd him from the clothes."
"He still had clothes on?"
"Uh-huh. One leg of the pants and most of the jacket. Custom made. They called the tailor in New York, and he confirmed that they had been made for George Morton. Will you be taking his effects with you?"
"I don't know," Evans said.
"Well, you're his lawyer."
"Yes, I guess I will."
"You have to sign for them."
They went back outside, where Jennifer was waiting. She was talking on her cell phone. She said, "Yes, I understand. Yes. Okay, we can do that." She flipped the phone shut when she saw them. "Finished?"
"Yes."
"And was it?"
"Yes," Ted said. "It was George."
Evans said nothing. He went down the hall and signed for the personal effects. The technician brought out a bag and handed it to Evans. Evans fished in it and pulled out the shreds of the tuxedo. There was a small Nerf pin on the inside pocket of the jacket. He reached in and came out with the watch, a Rolex Submariner. It was the same watch Morton wore. Evans looked at the back. It was engraved GM 123189. Evans nodded, put it back in the bag. All these things belonged to George. Just touching them now made him feel inexpressibly sad. "I guess that does it," he said. "Time to go." They all walked back to the waiting car. After they got in, Jennifer said, "We have to make another stop."
"Oh?" Evan said.
"Yes. We have to go to the Oakland Municipal Garage."
"Why?"
"The police are waiting for us."
Oakland, Tuesday, October 12th, 7:22 p.m. It was an enormous concrete structure, adjacent to a vast parking lot on the outskirts of Oakland. It was lit by harsh halogen lights. Behind the cyclone fence, most of the cars in the lot were junkers, but a few Cadillacs and Bentleys were there too. Their limousine pulled up to the curb.
"Why are we here?" Bradley said. "I don't understand."
A policeman came to the window. "Mr. Evans, Peter Evans?" "That's me. Come this way, please."
They all started to get out of the car. The cop said, "Just Mr. Evans." Bradley sputtered.
"But we are..."
"Sorry, sir. They just want Mr. Evans. You'll have to wait here."
Jennifer smiled at Bradley.
"I'll keep you company."
"Great."
Evans got out of the car and followed the policeman through the metal doors into the garage itself. The interior space was divided into long bays, where cars were worked on in a row. Most of the bays seemed to be given over to the repair of police cars. Evans smelled the sharp odor of acetylene torches. He sidestepped patches of motor oil and gobs of grease on the floor. He said to the cop accompanying him, "What's this about?"
"They're waiting for you, sir."
They were headed for the rear of the garage. They passed several crushed and blood-covered wrecks. Seats drenched in blood, shattered windows dark red. Some wrecks had pieces of string that stretched out from them in various directions. One wreck was being measured by a pair of technicians in blue lab coats. Another crash was being photographed by a man with a camera on a tripod.
"Is he a policeman?" Evans said.
"Nah, lawyer. We have to let him in."
"So you deal with car wrecks here?"
"When it's appropriate."
They came around the corner and Evans saw Kenner standing with three plainclothes policemen and two workers in blue lab coats. They were all standing around the crushed body of Morton's Ferrari Spider, now raised on a hydraulic lift, with bright lights shining up at it.
Peter, Kenner said, did you make the identification of George?
Yes.
Good man.
Evans came forward to stand beneath the car. Various sections of the underside had been marked with yellow cloth tags. Evans said,
okay, what's up?
The plainclothesmen looked at one another. One of them began to speak.
"We've been examining this Ferrari, Mr. Evans."
"I see that."
"This is the car that Mr. Morton recently bought in Monterey?"
"I believe so."
"When was that purchase made?"
"I don't know exactly." Evans tried to think back. "Not long ago. Last month or so. His assistant, Sarah, told me George had bought it."
"Who bought it?"
"She did."
"What was your involvement?"
"I had none.
She merely informed me that George had bought a car."
"You didn't make the purchase or arrange insurance, anything like that?"
"No. All that would have been done by George's accountants." "You never saw paperwork on the car?"
"No."
"And when did you first see the actual car itself?"
"The night George drove it away from the Mark Hopkins Hotel," Evans said.
"The night he died."
Did you ever see the car prior to that evening?
No.
Did you hire anyone to work on the car?
No.
The car was transported from Monterey to a private garage in Sonoma, where it remained for 2 weeks before being taken to San Francisco. Did you arrange the private garage?
No.
The rental was in your name.
Evan shook his head. I don't know anything about that, he said.
But Morton often put rentals and leases in the names of his accountants or attorneys if he didn't want the owner or lessee to be publicly known.
If he did that, he would inform you?
Not necessarily. So you didn't know your name was being used?
No.
Who worked on the car in San Jose?
I have no idea.
Because, Mr. Evans, somebody did rather extensive work on this Ferrari before Morton ever got into it. The frame was weakened at the places you see marked by the yellow tags. Anti-skid, primitive in a vehicle this old, was disabled, and the discs were cross-loosened on the left front, right rear. Are you following me here?
Evans frowned.
This car was a death trap, Mr. Evans. Someone used it to kill your client. Lethal changes were made in a garage in Sonoma, and your name is on the lease.
Downstairs in the car, Ted Bradley was grilling Jennifer Haynes. She might be pretty, but everything about her was wrong. Her manner, her tough guy attitude, and most of all, her opinions. She had said she was working on the lawsuit and that her salary was paid by NERF, but Ted didn't think it was possible. For one thing, Ted Bradley was very publicly associated with NERF, and as a hired employee, she should have known that, and she should have treated his opinions with respect. To call the information he had shared with those kids bullshit, a talk he didn't have to give, a moment he had offered out of the goodness of his heart and his dedication to the environmental cause, to call that bullshit was outrageous. It was confrontational in the extreme, and it showed absolutely no respect. Plus, Ted knew that what he had said was true, because as always, NERF had given him a talking points memo listing the various things to be emphasized. And NERF would not have told him to say anything that was untrue. And the talking points said nothing about the fucking ice age. Everything Jennifer had said was irrelevant. Those trees were magnificent. They were sentinels of the environment, just as the talking points claimed. In fact, he pulled the talking points out of his jacket pocket to be sure.
I'd like to see that, Jennifer said.
I bet you would.
What is your problem? She said. See, he thought. That kind of attitude? Aggressive and confrontational. She said, you're one of those television stars who thinks everyone wants to touch your dick. Well, guess what, oh big swinging one? I don't. I think you're just an actor.
And I think you're a plant. You're a corporate spy.
I must not be a very good one, she said, because you found me out.
Because you shot your mouth off, that's why.
It's always been my problem.
All during this conversation, Bradley felt a peculiar tension building in his chest. Women did not argue with Ted Bradley. Sometimes they were hostile for a while, but that was only because they were intimidated by him, his good looks, and his star power. They wanted to screw him. And often he'd let them. But they did not argue with him. This one was arguing. And it excited him and angered him in equal proportions. The tension building up inside him was almost unbearable. Her calmness, just sitting there, the direct way she looked into his eyes, the complete lack of intimidation. It was an indifference to his fame that drove him wild. All right, hell, she was beautiful. He grabbed her face in both hands and kissed her hard on the mouth. He could tell she liked it. To complete his dominance, he stuck his tongue down her throat.
Then there was a blinding flash of pain in his neck, his head, and he must have lost consciousness for a moment, because the next thing he knew, he was sitting on the floor of the limousine, gasping and watching blood drip all over his shirt. Ted was not sure how he had gotten there. He was not sure why he was bleeding or why his head was throbbing. Then he realized that his tongue was bleeding. He looked up at her. She crossed her legs coolly, giving him a glimpse up her skirt. But he didn't care. He was resentful.
You bit my tongue!
No, asshole. You bit your own tongue.
You assaulted me!
She raised an eyebrow.
You did! You assaulted me!
He looked down.
Jesus! This was a new shirt, too! From Maxfield's!
She stared at him.
You assaulted me!
He repeated.
So sue me.
I think I will.
Better consult your lawyer first.
Why?
She nodded her head toward the front of the car.
You're forgetting the driver.
What about him?
He saw it all.
So what? You encouraged me,
he said, hissing.
You were being seductive. Any guy knows the signs.
Apparently, you didn't.
Hostile ball breaker!
He turned and took the vodka bottle from the rack. He needed it to rinse out his mouth. He poured himself a glass and looked back. She was reading the talking points. She held the paper in her hands. He lunged for it.
That's not yours!
She was quick, holding the paper away from him. She raised her other hand, edge on like a chopping knife.
Care to try your luck again, Ted?
Fuck you,
he said, and took a big gulp of the vodka. His tongue was on fire.
What a bitch, he thought. What a goddamned bitch.
Well, she'd be looking for a new job tomorrow. He'd see to that. This bimbo lawyer couldn't fuck around with Ted Bradley and get away with it. Standing behind the crushed Ferrari, Evans endured another 10 minutes of grilling by the plane's clothesman who encircled him. Fundamentally, the story didn't make sense to him. Evans said, George was a good driver. If all these changes were made to the car, wouldn't he have noticed something was wrong? Perhaps. But not if he was drinking heavily. Well, he was drinking, that's for sure. And who got him the drinks, Mr. Evans? George got his own drinks. The waiter at the banquet said you were pushing drinks at Morton. That's not true. I was trying to limit his drinking. Abruptly, they changed course. Who worked on the Ferrari, Mr. Evans?
I have no idea.
We know you rented a private garage outside Sonoma on Route 54. It was fairly quiet and out of the way. Any person or persons who worked on the car would have been able to come and go as they wished, without being seen. Why would you choose such a garage?
I didn't choose it. Your name is on the lease.
How was the lease arranged?
By phone.
Who paid for it?
It was paid in cash.
By whom?
Delivered by messenger.
You have my signature on anything? Fingerprints?
No, just your name.
Evans shrugged. Then I'm sorry, but I don't know anything about this. It's well known that I'm George Morton's attorney. Anybody could have used my name. If anything was done to this car, it was done without my knowledge.
He was thinking that they should have been asking Sarah about all this, but then if they were good at their jobs, they'd already have talked to her.
And sure enough, she appeared from around the corner, talking on a cell phone and nodding to Kenner. That was when Kenner stepped forward. Okay, gentlemen, unless you have further questions, I'll take Mr. Evans into custody on my reconnaissance. I don't believe he is a flight risk. He'll be safe enough with me. The cops grumbled, but in the end they agreed. Kenner handed out his card, and then he headed back toward the entrance, his arm firmly on Evans's shoulder. Sarah followed some distance behind. The cops stayed with the Ferrari. As they neared the door, Kenner said, "Sorry about all that, but the police didn't tell you everything. The fact is, they photographed the car from various angles and fed the shots into a computer that simulates crashes. The computer-generated simulation didn't match the photos of the actual crash.
I didn't know you could do that.
Oh, yes. Everybody uses computer models these days. They are de rigueur for the modern organization. Armed with their computer simulation, the police went back to the wreck itself, where they now decided that it had been monkeyed with. They never imagined this during their previous examinations of the wreck, but now they do. Clear example of using a computer simulation to alter your version of reality. They trusted the simulation and not the data from the ground.
Uh-huh.
And of course, the simulation was optimized for the most common vehicle types in American roads. The computer had no ability to model the behavior of a 40-year-old limited production Italian racing car. They ran the simulation anyway.
Evans said, "But what's all this about a garage in Sonoma?"
Kenner shrugged. "You don't know. Sarah doesn't know. Nobody can even verify if the car was ever there. But the garage was rented, I guess by George himself, though we'll never know for sure." Back outside, Evans threw open the door to his limo and climbed in. He was astonished to see Ted Bradley covered in blood, all down his chin and shirt front.
"What happened?" "He slipped," Jennifer said, "and hurt himself."
End of CD 10.